not sick or struck dumb, or don't you know a kick when you see one can't quit? We're not done. We're gonna kick till the next one.
Hello, fine people, and welcome to The Kick. This is a movie podcast on the Now Playing Network where we dream in themes, and every genre is habit forming. We are in the midst of our second kick, a series on sports romances, culminating in the release of Challengers in late April. And mind you, we're spotlighting sports romances where all parties in the romance have some skin in the game, or rackets in the hand in this case. Today we're talking about 2004's Wimbledon, a movie I had never seen, but wanted to include in The Kick because, like Challengers, it is a romance between tennis players, here played by Paul Bettany and Kirsten Dunst. Here to break it down with me is beloved friend, former Be Real host, and literary agent at Verve. He is still waiting for them to make that movie about our legendary 2013 badminton game. It's Noah Ballard.
What's up, Chance? Thanks for having me. I feel like we're on a bit of a kick.
You want to comment on that game, how it turned out, the flow of it, whether the momentum turned at all at any point?
Are you talking about the time that you and me and Casey Welsh and...
Yeah, my friend Neil.
Wait, who was your friend who?
Neil.
Oh, Neil. I remember Neil.
Right.
Listen, I feel like much like Paul Bettany in the 2004 film Wimbledon, we just like weren't in the best shape of our lives.
No, not like now.
Not like, yeah, we were not the Adonises that we now are in our mid-30s. We were 22 and smoking two packs a day.
The movie Wimbledon? Had you ever seen?
I feel like I'd seen the trailer enough to feel like I had seen the movie.
Sure.
But I don't think I'd ever seen it.
Me neither.
I hadn't watched it in the traditional sense.
At any point in your life, do you feel like you confused it with Match Point, a much darker film?
No, I really liked Match Point. They are pretty similar in that they're both like British.
That's right. Came out a year apart.
Yeah. British tennis movies. God, what a time to be alive.
You ever play tennis?
It's tough to say.
Not in the traditional sense.
Not in the traditional sense. No, I feel like I've like been at a country club once and maybe at a fancy person's house once and like hit a few balls around, maybe like gym class in high school. Mm-hmm. I do remember a terrible twosome of me and the gym teacher, Mr. Underwood.
You play doubles against other students?
I mean, it wasn't like a formal league, Chance. It was just to kill 45 minutes, seventh period.
Interesting. You and the teacher.
But Underwood and I went for it, and I remember us winning at least one game.
That's good. That's a good memory.
Yeah.
Would you care to bring us into the film Wimbledon by reading the IMDb synopsis in your inimitable way?
I really have. I do miss in my personal life the ability to just randomly take a stand and read an IMDb profile. So,
do it.
A tennis player has lost his ambition and has fallen into rank 119th. Fortunately for him, he meets a young player on the women's circuit who helps him recapture his focus for Wimbledon.
Peter Colt was once a rising star.
Once ranked 15th in the world, are you?
11th, actually.
Who never rose to the top.
That's Peter Colt, once ranked 17th in the world.
11th!
Now, in his final tournament.
Since this may well be my last Wimbledon press conference, I'd like to announce my retirement from...
It's Jake!
Tennis. That's my retirement from tennis.
He's about to meet someone who knows what it takes to win.
Oops, sorry, wrong court.
Lives in property, right?
Yeah. $10 says you can't hit two in a row. You're exceeding my expectations.
Mine too.
Hit this one, and I'll sleep with you.
Ow!
Too bad. You could have used the workout.
My daughter's on a roll right now, but I don't want her to have any distractions.
Right. Of course. Sorry, just to clarify, do you see me as a distraction?
This fall, the guy everyone counted out.
Go out there and decide who you are.
Might not be.
Might be a winner.
incredible. This is the first seeded player he's defeated in 2 years.
Is now the guy everyone's talking about.
So Peter Colt, Paul Bettany, is a reedy British tennis has-been. Now in his early 30s, he's on the verge of taking a job as a country club's tennis director. But you know, at that stage in life, might as well give Wimbledon one last go. Checking into his hotel on the first day of the tournament, he is mistakenly given the key to a suite where American tennis star Lizzie Bradbury, and here's where I want to stop for a second, Peter Colt, Lizzie Bradbury, I want to invoke Burt Reynolds and Boogie Nights. These are great names!
They are great names, yeah. Chance, before you go further, can we talk about the tagline for this movie, which I feel like sets it up pretty good?
Tell me, what is it?
She's the golden girl. He's the long shot. It's a match made in Wimbledon.
I see what they tried to do there. The golden girl is played by Kirsten Dunst. And when Peter stumbles into her hotel room, bad mistake by the hotel, she's showering.
She's really chill about it, though.
Oh, my God. Oopsie, oopsie, flirty, flirty. It's totally fine that you're here. I'll go back to my correct room now. But that's right. A meet cute that sets off Lizzie and Peter hooking up before every round of Wimbledon, much to the eyes-narrowing chagrin of Lizzie's father, played by Sam Neill, your typical controlling athlete dad. And then for most of the movie, we're in the teeth of the tournament, and Lizzie is also winning, we guess. But the real surprise is that Peter is winning. It's a last hurrah for him that involves a lot of luck, a fair bit of superstition, and just playing like there's no tomorrow. Will Peter go all the way? Will Liz crumble under the tabloid pressure of their whirlwind romance? It's a match made in Wimbledon.
Yeah, there's some real, like, for love of the game vibes in this one. It's just like an old geezer just dusting it off for one final chance at glory.
It's funny you say that because I thought about For Love of the Game as kind of the paradigmatic example of movies I did not want to cover on this kick, where like the love interest is like so sidelined as to like be in a different movie. This is what we'll talk about. Like, how does the fact that Lizzie is also a tennis star help this movie? But I think she does get, unfortunately, a little Adrian zoned by the end.
She gets absolutely cheesed by this romance. this romance doesn't, not to spoil the movie, it doesn't help her at all.
No.
In fact, it uproots her life in a way that it maybe by the end she'd given up professional tennis.
We know that not to be true, thanks to one of the sweatiest epilogues you've ever seen in your entire life.
Sure.
Real quick before we get to the larger discussion questions, put together a little tale of the tape here.
Oh my. Can you explain that further?
What is a tale of the tape?
Are you getting, it's like the technical details?
The technical details, you got it. Fastest serve, 144. I don't know. I think that's the fastest serve of the movie.
Fastest serve featured on screen, 144. That's right.
Length, 98 minutes. Box office, oof, 41.5 million.
Against what? Does it?
Oh, 31? Like a real, you know, got to the middle. Got to the middle, probably no profit. How about this note? It shared a release weekend in September 2004 with Sky Captain World of Tomorrow, Mr. 3000, and Resident Evil Apocalypse. What a time at the American Cineplex.
Now, are you going to do Mr. 3000 for this category?
Is at any point the titular Mr. 3000 in love with another baseball player?
Well, I've never seen the film in the traditional sense.
Or Mr. Is the 3000 the other players he's
in love
with?
If there's a Mr. 3000, there is an implied Mrs. 3000.
That's right. All right, I'll add it to the end. I'll email you if I decide to go that route.
Take out Challengers. What is that? A space movie?
Right.
I do Mr. 3000 instead.
Oh dear. Number of times in the film that John McEnroe and Chris Everett loudly suggest that Peter Colt sucks at tennis. It's about a half dozen. Director Richard Lon Crane, who made the acclaimed Richard III adaptation and the somewhat less acclaimed film Firewall, also starring Paul Bettany. I believe Harrison
Ford. He's got a Bettany kick.
Favorite part of Firewall is always that Harrison Ford puts a pickaxe through Paul Bettany. cinematographer Darius Kanji, which I bring up primarily to note the similarities to, like, he just shot Panic Room with Fincher, and the way that he, like, moves the fake camera through the wall is very similar to how some of the tennis balls move with the fake camera in this movie. Actors from Lord of the Rings, one, it's Bernard Hill, who I know you're excited to talk about, Noah, yeah?
Yes.
actors from Game of Thrones, one, Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who plays Paul Bettany, Peter Colt's best friend, a German player called Dieter. Why couldn't he just be Danish? Years since last a British man had won Wimbledon when this movie came out was 68. And I feel like that is something that was, like, very lost on me as I was, like, trying to, like, they really make a big deal out of Peter Colt playing, who ended up being another fake player, like Tom Cavendish. They're like, it's the Battle of the Brits in the quarterfinals. People are losing their minds. And it was because there was this long-standing tradition at Wimbledon where, like, it was the most iconic tennis tournament in the world, an extremely British institution, but British players were not winning it. And nobody did until Andy Murray in, I think, 2013. It was like a 75-year drought or something like that. So they were sort of imagining the media frenzy around this broken down man pulling it out. Noah Ballard, I'm about to give you the floor, buddy. This is a rom-com and a sports movie pushed together in an, I think, extremely 2004 way. How's the balance of this genre for you in Wimbledon?
Between the sports movie of it and the rom-com of it.
Yes.
I don't want to tip my hand too early, Chance, to take away from the possible conflicts we could get into. Uh-huh. But I think this is a pretty bad movie. And I think that there's something miraculous about how kind of rote both the sports story and the romantic story are.
Okay.
Do you want me to be more specific?
Go on. Tell me of their roteness.
So I live alone, and sometimes when I watch a movie, I just tell the apartment what I think is going to happen out loud.
Sure.
And just see what happens. In this one, I was able to do the five scenes that comprise the third act in a way. I was like, oh, she's coming back soon, isn't she? He's going to hit a little lull in his game, and she's going to come back, and they're going to have a talk. And then I bet there's an injury scare that really, like, you know, throws his natural ability into question, how much he's going to have to dig deep, you know, things like that. And it was like, these are movie tropes, or at least, like, narrative tropes that felt like, I don't know, I don't want to be too mean to it, but...
No, that's all right. It's pretty by the numbers.
It's by the numbers, yeah. And I mean, maybe it wasn't as by the numbers in 2004, but it's also incredible. Like, it's also incredible how by the numbers it is, and like the star power that's kind of there too. Like, Kirsten Dunst, I think, gives a little credence to how ridiculous they really, like, it only takes them three scenes to fall in love.
Yeah.
And then have that fight where it's like, you just were trying to have sex, like, and you now you think it's a lucky thing, and that's the streak, and you don't actually care about me. And it's like, well, yeah, this is a bad guy. This is like an anti-hero from 2004. Like, he literally sabotaged your chances to win this year for his own gain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think there are like some specifics. I was curious, I was trying to figure out the writing, like how the writing of this movie took shape. Because it is, and what I could ascertain was that the original script was written by Jennifer Flackett and Mark Levine, a screenwriting duo who made such movies as Madeline, Little Manhattan, Journey to the Center of the Earth, Nim's Island, a kind of curious, like, you know, make family pictures. And then it was rewritten by Adam Brooks, who is a real rom-com voice of that era. Practical Magic, Bridget Jones, the second movie, Definitely Maybe, which he also directed. So my suspicion is that the original script has the more like hardcore tennis stuff in it. And then Adam Brooks came in and made it.
Well, there's
like,
very little tennis. Like, you asked about it being a sports movie, and it's like a lot of the outcomes of the actual games we get in conversations after they've occurred. Like, we find out that he's won the first game in a conversation between his parents. Then the second one cuts to a locker room, you know, after he's beaten his best friend. Like, you don't actually see a lot of it. And then I have to say that the actual, you know, the big game, the big match is so goofy.
In what way?
I mean, you were talking about the cinematography before, and I almost felt like they just so go for the, and now the camera's the ball, and now the world is the ball, and, you know, and now we're going to shoot from, like, yeah, this Fincher kind of going through walls, kind of time stops, like the zoom in on the eye, and like the, you know, kind of, and there's something maybe charming about, well, I guess my question to you also is, do you feel if Paul Bettany's charming enough to play this role that was clearly written for someone more like Hugh Jackman or Hugh Grant?
It literally was written for Hugh Grant.
That was literally, yeah.
Yep. let me try to address those in order. So to come back real quick, like, there are some cool, like, tennis aphorisms that I think are in the original version of the script, like in the very first, when it's like the round of 132 or whatever, and Peter's like, he's going to play this 18-year-old who's on the come up and nobody knows who Peter Colt is and his press conference is empty. Peter and his friend Dieter are like looking across the cafeteria at the 18-year-old and they're like, what do you think about that guy? What do you know about that guy? And he's like, oh yeah, I played him. You know, he's like all 18-year-old tennis players, like, wants to kill his father and needs to be taught to respect his elders. And Paul Bettany's like, so did you teach him that when you played? He's like, no, he killed his father in straight sets. Which I like. I like stuff like that, because that feels very of the sport, could only be of a sport where, like, you know, the hot new players are all like 18 and these guys are getting worn down. But your other question about, like, how is the tennis leads me to want to discuss that, because, like, they make some interesting choices. I know that Richard Longcrane, the director, really did not want it to look like televised tennis, that you never wanted to use that camera angle, which a movie like, say, Battle of the Sexes, the Emma Stone, Steve Carell historical movie, like, that really is just TV tennis angles the whole time, and it is kind of boring as sin. So this is it might be like a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing.
Sure.
Because, like, how does tennis play on screen for you, even?
I mean, I don't know, like, the way to do it well. I don't have, like, a note for it. I just think this movie kind of visually has a bounciness to it.
Sure.
That kind of keeps it from, I don't know, feeling that gripping of, like, a sports narrative. The movie sort of feels like a long montage.
Yes.
Like, there's so much cutting to, like, you know, inexplicably, the story of the century, live from London, you know, where the paparazzi are outside these two people who are sleeping together's apartments, these adults who are not that interesting. They're just tennis players. Why would there have been such a big crowd there?
I think it would be like, but it would be like if some, you know, washed up, barely ranked guy was like had a fling with Serena Williams during the U.S. Open. It'd be a big deal.
When I have watched tennis, like, what's interesting about it is seeing who volley to volley has the upper hand.
Totally.
And then, you know, it gets a little worse for one person, but then it gets back and then a surprise thing and a lucky thing. And I don't know that the movie ever figured out a way to kind of hold that tension in a way that looked believable.
That's a good way to describe it. Yeah, because it's really, like volleyball, it's really stressful. You're waiting for someone to fuck up. But yeah. when it's not real, it's not like something like boxing or football or baseball that is like more inherently cinematic and like persona driven.
Right.
Yeah. I will say, in defense of the tennis, everywhere I read, the actors did their own serving. And I do think that Paul Bettany looks very good and believable serving as just like sort of a slender, yeah, like 6'2" dude.
God, especially when he tweaks his back.
Oh my God. When he's, cause there's like, he has one more point left in that one. And he's like, this is going to hurt. And he just like reaches up toward the sky. And unfortunately they cut away at that moment, which is stupid, but like it was set up well.
It was set up well. Well, it's like the same thing that Kevin Costner says, like when he's in the ninth inning
has
to throw that fastball and he's like, this one's going to hurt.
Billy Chappell, another for love of
Billy
the game.
Billy Chappell.
Going back. Chappie, how you doing up there?
In the twilight of his career, a last moment at greatness. your point was funnier earlier with there's so many times when it throws to McEnroe and he's like, now I'm not saying he should do this, but if I were in his position, I would just like forfeit the game. Like there's no way he comes back from this. And then he will be a laughing stock to his community.
One of the quotes from McEnroe I wrote down is, this is primo choke time.
Yeah. This guy is known to choke. He is what we call a choker. He will choke. There's no universe in which he doesn't choke right now.
Last thing I'll say about the sheer tennis of it all is I do think that Kirsten Dunst has a great tennis face. When she hits the ball, the exertion on her face is very believable. She's
an actor.
That's
a good way to say it. Yeah. Kirsten Dunst's tennis face.
Yeah.
She has my favorite Kirsten Dunst line reading of the film.
What is it?
Were you going to bring this up?
What is it?
Love means nothing in tennis. Zero. It only means you lose. Such a good line.
Yeah. It's like the ultimate solo sport. What does companionship mean to these people? They're not playing doubles like you and Coach Underwood.
Exactly. It's not like me and Casey, the badminton court.
How about the chemistry, the romantic chemistry between Bettany and Dunst? Does that do anything for you?
I've got a question for you.
Right.
Where do you come down on the whole fooling around before a match issue?
Well, that's a very intriguing question.
I think a little fooling around can be really good for your game. You know, help you relax.
I'm not sure I've done enough research to have a definitive opinion.
That's very sad.
Yes, it is, isn't it? It is. It's very sad. Don't get me wrong, I'm very interested in doing the necessary research.
I just think it's kind of goofy. Like, I don't know that I saw that. Or saw it more than, I think if the movie plays it more like, yes, this is just a guy who gets into this thing where he has to sleep with this girl in order to continue to win. And he pursued that with reckless abandon. I think the Bettany character makes more sense, but the movie teeing up they're going to spend their lives together and have children. Like, I don't know about all that.
First of all, the first time they sleep together, you see nothing. You don't even see them like enter the bedroom together. They just like turn around and they're like, I think we're going to do this. So it's very, very tossed off, which kind of sets you up to believe like, so this is very, this doesn't hold a lot of meaning for them. It's literally just like, make sure you tie your shoes with the same knot before the big match. And so you could advance like more of a superstition comedy, where from round to round to round, they have to do the same thing in crazier and crazier circumstances. But then they just drive to Brighton instead.
Right. Yeah, it becomes like a, you know, a very good year or something. No, I think if they had played out the, you know, Olympic Village syndrome, so to speak, where people just like hook up and then like falling into a pattern of that feeds into these people's superstitions. Like, that's a more compelling reason for them to be like, oh, we both won and we had sex yesterday. We should probably have sex a second time so we can both win again. But she quickly jettisons winning. I think it's, that's a problem with the movie too, how quickly it gives up on her also like having a thing.
Totally. Well, I think in retrospect, it sort of does her dirty in terms of just like, I don't even know how she did the first four rounds of the tournament. Good, I guess. Like, Sam Neill's mad the whole time, but was she doing fine? We don't even know.
Unclear. Yeah. And then I feel like the movie kind of moralizes at the end of like, oh, well, she's a child. You know, she'll have plenty of years to win. Give it to this old man who's on his last legs professionally. He deserves it more.
I pulled two quotes here. One of them is from the confrontation scene where Lizzie says to Peter, I think the thing you fell in love with this week is winning. And then another quote is about Peter having to play his best friend Dieter, Nikolai Coster-Waldau, and he goes, well, it's not like I have to kill him. And she says, do you know what it takes to close out a friend in the third round of Wimbledon? Because that's killing him. Quotes like that, do you think that it betrays a much darker movie that is not realized here?
I think perhaps a better movie. I think it is more, there's clearly a movie about obsession here. Because it's just not moments like him crawling up the side of that building,
that's,
you know, to get to her, like, are not earned.
No.
Like, we need to know that either this guy is madly in love with this person or he's so obsessed with the idea that he needs to sleep with her in order to win the next game that he'll go to any length.
I do think like the tableau of this movie, like the without the pieces in motion, like it is like very, very good theoretical casting. Like, I have looked at this poster for years and been like, I need to see that fucking movie. Because like Paul Bettany really does look like a washed up like Andy Roddick or Andy Murray type. And she really does look like Maria Sharapova. And the way that Kanji shoots like the crowd and the green of the grass, like, it is really like people when they're just kind of standing there, they have a great look. It's like it's been imagined. It's just like when people start moving and start talking, it goes awry, which is part of movies.
No, I mean, I want to compliment to the movie for being such a small movie. It feels like a very big movie.
Sure.
Because there's just so many characters doing all kinds of stuff.
Yeah,
like they managed to get into, like, he has the relationship with like the pick me out a winner Bobby Ball boy.
Love that.
But that sort of makes my other point too. I love how kind of camp it is.
Uh-huh.
Like a movie that allows an 8-year-old child to be nearly blinded by a tennis ball as like a reason for Peter Cole to step up, and then he's unable to do so as a second joke. That's unbelievable.
I had this written down later where I feel like we're stepping on some of my joke questions, which is totally fine, but like, yeah, that guy Jack Hammond serving an 144 mile per hour ball into the eye socket of this boy, like, that's right up
and
there.
And then he's
with,
back.
Like,
he's back by the end of the match.
Oh yeah, and Peter's just like, "You all right there, old chap?" The boy's like, "Yes."
And it's like his eyeballs hanging out of his socket. He's like, "I'm all right. I'm all right, sir. Good luck."
As you said, sprawling and entertaining supporting cast. Who worked for you? Who didn't? Who do you want to shout out?
I thought McAvoy was great as the brother who consistently bets against his own brother.
20 pounds to win. AJ back. Hold on. Isn't he playing your brother?
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah, but curiously, I'm not.
Yeah, who bikes down to the William Hill and like...
can't seem to park his bike ever. That's his main character trait. And then, yeah, he bets against his brother. And then, but he then creates this kind of little community that's actually rooting for Peter Colt.
That's
it's
right.
Like, yeah, cutting to a bedroom somewhere in England. And then it also, there's like a larger family reconciliation that happens. Like that's, I thought that that was also like a kind of interesting, if underexplored, tendril of this movie is the relationship of his, of Peter's parents.
Yeah, played by Eleanor Braun and Bernard Hill, who like live out in the country. And why are they not getting along? She was snogging with someone at the club.
Because he's not winning. Peter's not winning. That's the thing that brings them all together.
That's right. That's true. What a healthy family. But it leads to this very, I think it was my loudest laugh of the movie, where, you know, Peter doesn't want them at Wimbledon because he's like, I never win when you guys are there. And so they're both kind of like obsessed with his career, but also, you know, like spurned by that. Like, fine, then I won't even watch. And his mom just like works in the garden, but she's not getting along with the dad, Bernard Hill, who's decided to like sweep out the treehouse and live up there because they're not getting along. But once Peter does start to win, she climbs up in the treehouse, and there's this very funny scene where he kind of like, you know, bends her down as if in a dance, like a half drop. What do you even call that when? Anyway, you know what I'm talking about?
Dip me.
Dip me. That's it. That's it. Yeah, he dips her, and she like sees this this meat that he's grilling up there in the treehouse, and
I know.
And he
really does linger on those rabbits in kind of like an erotic way.
Rabbit, I caught it messing with your lettuce, and then they kiss deeply.
Well, that's also because she's so annoyed by the rabbits eating her garden that it was like he really spoke her love language by killing them.
Yeah, that's right. And then later they're
the critters, baby.
They're fucking loudly in the kitchen, which Peter walks in on, and she says
he
wants
it's his brother's pornography at first, but it turns out it's his own parents.
Because early in the movie, tell me if this is a joke that landed for you. James McAvoy is watching Deep Throat, the director's cut.
Hilarious.
Is that known to be a yeah? I think that's funny. But yeah, he thinks it's the porn, but it's the parents. And then she's like,
who then like are mid-coitus, look back at him and they go, it's because of you winning, Peter. It's the thing we have in common. We wouldn't be having sex if it wasn't for you. We thought about you the whole time.
All of that is implied. That's subtext.
That's subtext. I just for clarity, that was subtext. That's not a line anyone says.
Eggs and soldiers, she says to her son. He says, just eggs, thank you.
That's pretty good.
Noah, would you like to move on to our own montage round?
Oh, please.
Let's think about all the great sports movies from all the many years, Noah. The Natural, Pride of the Yankees, others, to be sure. Any of these sports movies in Hollywood history had the opportunity after the climactic match to zoom out, to be the world, and then have the world be the ball. And none of them took it until this movie.
Well, it's sort of like Men in Black by way of tennis.
Yeah, that's right. And then a tennis racket hits the world.
I mean, I get the joke. I mean, I feel like the whole movie is not building up to. I feel like the whole movie is not building up to an emotional climax. It's building up to that shot.
Yeah.
And if you look at it through that lens of like, what would be a cool moment to have a zoom out and have the world be a tennis ball and then get exploded by a racket, then a lot of it makes more sense.
And then they're like in New York on a somewhat rundown court. And he's like, we have children now. And Lizzie did win Wimbledon and the U.S. Open twice. And then it's dedicated to who? David McCormick, who like founded IMG. It's just a very weird last 90 seconds after very standard previous 90 minutes.
Yeah. That is kind of the dedication is odd.
Like, what is David? I mean, like, if you research, like, David McCormick had a lot to do with, like, tennis rankings and just, like, sports agenting and, of course, everything. But, like, what has he to do with this film?
Yeah, it was sort of like, why did Meg Ryan dedicate her most recent travesty to the movie opens with for Nora, the implication being for Nora Ephron.
That's right. Oh boy.
It's yucky.
And that was Mark McCormick. Sorry. Didn't want to refer to him as David.
R.I.P.
Noah, the most questionable training tactic seen in the movie Wimbledon. Is it A, going on a multi-hour jog in Chuck Taylor's the day before quarterfinals? Not advisable. Is it eating fish and chips consecutive nights during Wimbledon? Or not having any coaches?
That, I have to say, it's not having any coaches. It's so weird that they go for the Favreau agent instead of the coach.
Yeah.
Or that they have the best friend and not the coach. And then they try to have the coach. They try to have their fucking cake and eat it too, Chance, when they try to turn the head attendant of the locker room into the coach. And it's like, he's not the coach. We know what he does. There's no reason that his inspirational do it for England man or whatever, that doesn't carry any water.
I agree with that. It is a little strange. And definitely like a missed opportunity, right? Like in that first press conference when no one's listening to him, someone could be like, where's your coach? He'd be like, I'm ranked 119 in the world. I don't have the money to hire one. And then like people could start, you know, throwing themselves at him as he advances the rankings.
Totally.
Never happens.
Or you know, Anthony Hopkins comes out of nowhere, you know, being like,
oh my,
I haven't seen you in 10 years, but I'm back now. And then maybe he has a rapport with Sam Neill.
Interesting. I just recorded an episode on The Cutting Edge with the writer and professor Emily L. Newman. It was great to talk to her. I said, Emily, we're doing Wimbledon next. She said, oh, I remember seeing that in theaters when Paul Bettany's bare ass is on screen. That was life-changing.
Is his bare ass?
In front of the mirror in that like montage when he's deciding what undies to wear.
And oh, he's like, what about undies? a little strip of top butt.
Oh, it seemed like a fair bit of butt. I think the question is that his butt, though?
Oh, you think it's a butt double?
He's not
double.
In the shot. I don't want to say.
Oh, it's just a little tush.
Well, it would be a little tush either way, but...
I guess I don't remember specifically this shot. I mean, I remember a mirror shot and being like, oh, there's his crack. But I didn't clock it the way your esteemed interviewee did.
Not only is his life not changed, he didn't remember it was in the movie. All right. Noah, my friend,
sir?
Would you like to play what's become a recurring segment on the show, Truth or Trivia? If you pick Truth, you have to try to answer maybe a somewhat difficult movie-related question about your life or movie opinion. Trivia is trivia about the movie. So what do you want to do, truth or trivia?
How about we start with the trivia?
Okay, let's start with an easy one. Do you know from this movie how Paul Bettany got into the MCU?
What connection he made?
Yes.
Like how he met Favreau?
That's right.
Who then brought him into the Iron Man?
You got it.
As Jarvis?
As Jarvis. Very good.
Ugh. Okay, I was overthinking it.
Was that disturbingly easy?
Yeah, a little.
What world event does Paul Bettany credit for inspiring him to call up Jennifer Connelly and propose?
Like real life Paul Bettany.
Mm-hmm.
World event. Did it happen before or after this movie was released?
Before.
Don't say it's 9/11.
Yeah.
Are we going to go a single podcast where we don't talk about 9/11, Chance?
Not this one.
We're right on the edge. We're right on the edge of how many times we talk about it.
Noah, for old time's sake, would you like to rate this movie in the good, good, bad, 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 good, good, bad taxonomy?
Oh my God. I've enjoyed talking to you about it. Our lively discussions about cinema are one of life's true joys. So that being said, I'm feeling generous to the text itself. So I will give it a charitable bad good.
I would do the same. I liked being in the world. I do think it looked good. I like spending it had an environmental authenticity to it, if not like a swing for swing authenticity, and I was into that. But yeah, the moment I think you start breaking it down with someone such as yourself, it just becomes apparent, like, what happened here? And this could so easily be more daring, entertaining, funny, even-handed in like a million different ways.
Yeah. Case closed.
Challengers? You anticipating that Luca Guadagnino Zendaya movie at all?
I saw the trailer for it ahead of this very podcast, and I have to say, it looks intriguing. I really, because I think, you know, with the filmmakers in question, you're going to get something that's like, how do you go from making like Call Me By Your Name to like a middle of the road or that crazy fucking when Timothy Chalamet like eats people,
Bones and All.
Like, yeah. how do you go from that to making what appears to be kind of like a polyamory Wimbledon? So right. It's there's got to be something there.
I think so. And it looks a fair bit darker, and it looks like more of the competition of like who gets to sleep with who or who has the upper hand in the romantic relationship may play out on the court, which I would welcome.
I would welcome that too. The only question mark for me, Chance, and let me know if this is something that's on your mind about Challengers, is how gory is the injury going to be?
Oh.
Because it looks from, there's a real good snap in that, in the trailer. So
oh, it's bones knowing, and all, I think.
Yeah, I think it may be bones and all. Like we may, like I think a bone may come through Zendaya's leg.
Mm. Boy, 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 boy. But yeah, I look forward to it.
Yeah. Noah Ballard? When is that coming out?
No, that's okay. It's coming out on April 26th.
Wow.
Yeah. Give me a late spring subversive sports romance.
Incredible. Well, I look forward to seeing it. And Chance, always a pleasure.
Anything you want to plug?
No.
Okay, then I'll take.
I don't want anyone reaching out to me or supporting me in any way.
I'll take the previous ending that you teed up for me, and I'll say nothing else.
Perfect.